What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. This episode of The Katie Helper Show is from a live discussion we had at the People's Forum after a public screening of the documentary Holy Redemption, Stealing Palestinian Land, a TRT documentary about the terror tactics of the Israeli settler group Hilltop Youth, an organization that builds outposts in order to steal more land from Palestinians. I speak to Ashish Prashar, a political strategist, human rights activist, and former advisor to the Middle East Peace Envoy, Leah Begoli, a musician and martial arts instructor just back from volunteering in the West Bank, and Daniel Santiago, a high school teacher and community organizer from Jersey City, who volunteered for 2 weeks in the West Bank and was shot in the leg by the Israeli army. The screening and discussion were sponsored by Code Pink and the People's Forum. Thank you so much to the People's Forum and to Code Pink, to these amazing panelists and to everyone coming out and watching at home. So I want to start off, before we talk about this film and the themes in it, just getting a sense from all of you, all three of you, what your experiences were like in the West Bank, what brought you there, what you were doing, et cetera.
Well, mine's going to be different to the other guys. I was working for the Middle East Peace Envoy, then Tony Blair, already established a war criminal at that point. So the oxymoron of him being the peace envoy is not lost on anyone.
What is a peace envoy?
It's a body set up by the UN, the US, the EU to foster peace in the Middle East. And also simultaneous to that, they were trying to economically develop the West Bank and Gaza at the time to show that they actually cared about the Palestinian side of this whole, I don't even know what to call it anymore, but just to show the Palestinians, the Europeans, the Americans were invested in this future state. That work actually proceeded and until they sealed off Gaza. But the work of the actual peace process was all a facade. Like, it was a way for the West to show that, you know, that we actually cared and we were trying to do something. Remember, also politically, it was off the table for a while because everyone was so focused on Iraq and Afghanistan, right? So sending Blair there was like a way for them to even distract from that madness that they've caused in the rest of the Middle East. It was a way for them to show they were sending someone there who would be taken serious by the region because of all the actions he took in Iraq, which, again, you want to believe. Well, I, at the time, I'm going to speak for myself, I can't speak for all my colleagues, we wanted to believe that, you know, Blair had negotiated the Good Friday Agreement. And again, another long-standing conflict in Europe, you know, when Ireland still kind of has a colony on it with Northern Ireland, so it's not exactly really resolved for the Irish people. And you wanted to believe he was trying to redeem his legacy, right, with Iraq. So a lot of people went into it thinking this was a way to actually change something. What we learned was that our mission was to just continue the Israeli line of everything. You know, we'd have meetings with the PA, the Israeli government. We'd see issues around the table, and we'd have an agreed line that was solved for both parties, but we would only publish the line that was approved by the Israelis. The economic development programs, they were designed in a way also that we could foster the bullshit that we can't give money directly to the Palestinian governments because they're full of terrorists. So we'd do things like microfinancing projects that would get money directly to Palestinian communities. But it also kind of played into the propaganda that we can't work with the Palestinian government. We have to work directly with the Palestinian people, causing division in itself. The whole thing was designed, weirdly, to undermine any Palestinian authority, quite literally, in its own region. What was really interesting, just quickly, before I know we're going to talk about the documentary at length, but like seeing that the development of the settlements since I left in 2011 is mind-blowing, and the acceleration. Our job also is to uphold international law in that role. Our job is to report what we see. We saw settlements back then, and we reported it to the EU, the US, the UN, and never had the whip been cracked on Israel, even then, to stop that. And you think of the acceleration that's happened since that. It shows an office that was designed to give Palestine its territory just turned a blind eye, and the governments in charge of that office basically took those reports and probably shredded them. And my experience of seeing apartheid was, again, I would say more in a weird way privileged. And I went through those checkpoints in diplomatic cars, right? So I never, you know, experienced it firsthand, not with people who actually volunteer there and work there. But it was at a checkpoint at the outskirts of Ramallah where I literally watched IOS soldiers beating a Palestinian child. And the driver telling me that he's probably a terrorist. I'm like, he's 12 years old. And you only have to see what you saw with the way they treat kids and that. That was my experience of like, he had to go through two sets of checkpoints and then the other end of it was just beaten up. That is their daily life. And that was 2011. And I know from what I know from people who still worked in those roles that it progressively got worse. And it's been like that forever, but like the treatment has been more openly violent. It was always restrictive. It was always apartheid. It was always, you know, you can't go down certain roads. You can't live in certain places. You can't have access to certain water wells. But the violence that you're seeing today and the last few years, the acceleration of that has definitely become more public and also just shameless. And, you know, it does help that their parent government in the United States, whatever administration, Republican, Democrat, is just like okay with the crimes they commit. So they get away with it. You know, what was really interesting to me in that, again, we'll talk about it, is the court stuff, because there's a real parallel to how we're treating Israeli crimes here and who investigates them. In the end of the day, I didn't have the same experience that the other two colleagues here are going to talk about, but it was very visible that our institutions were designed to uphold what you saw. Our governments are working to uphold what you saw. And didn't take more than 6 months for me to resign because of that. Because that was not why any of us chose to do that work. That is not why anyone, and I can't believe people stayed in it, but that's not why people who I think believed in what they believed in to go out there to try and foster some semblance of a settlement to establish a Palestinian state went out there to do that. It was very apparent working there for a few months even. Like I worked in the role for a couple of years, but a few months out there that our governments would designed an envoy's office to uphold Israeli supremacy over the Palestinian people.
Lair, let's turn to you and what brought you to the West Bank and what you did there.
I'll start with the film because it was difficult for me to watch. I couldn't take notes fast enough. Like everything they mentioned, I was there for 5 weeks and I had more or less experienced that. You know, the settler raids, the just being around soldiers, seeing how soldiers act, the apartheid that was mentioned. You know, violence against my volunteers. The reason I went is, you know, after seeing what Israel was doing to Gaza, I became more involved with activism and going to protests. And I left my job in May going into June, and I had some money saved up and I saw an opportunity to volunteer and I wanted to do something more. And it was a life-changing 5 weeks for me. It was really intense. The intensity of life over there is like astounding. But that's why I went. And it's just kind of deepened my support for the Palestinian people and the need for their liberation.
Hello. So why I went there, right? So back in 2012, I was in collaboration with Palestinians, part of Anak Bayan, a national democratic movement of the Philippines, And we were in collaboration with some Palestinians. They came to our studies. They really were inspired. And they created Within Our Lifetime Palestine. Nerdine told me that, and I was surprised. I was like, what? Because I always saw support from Palestinians for the Philippine movement, for true national and true sovereignty for our nation and true democracy. And then they were always there by our side. So when I came back for a Labor Day protest, she asked me to come up and she told me that story. So it's really beautiful to see the collaboration of different movements and being able to create different organizations, right? Anak Bayan, Within Our Lifetime. So I always had, I guess, interest in the Palestinian movement, learning more since 2012, and then the escalation of October 7th. I'm a teacher, I'm a high school teacher, and once it happened, I think I kind of went on autopilot. As I tried to be manual as much as I could, but it was just really tough. Every day, going in, teaching, as if nothing's happening, like there's no genocide happening, you know, on our phones, in our lives, every day. And then it actually started with, I left my kiffy outside. I had a smoke break, bringing my students' snacks in for the last week of school so they can enjoy some movies. And then someone took it. So I had to buy another kafia, and it came with a postcard. It was really beautiful. It was like, thank you for your support. And on the right side, it said invitation to visit. So through all my activism over the years, someone reached out to me, my friend Navi from the student movement in like California. She's like, check out FASA. So that's the protective presence organization that me and Liar was, we went with. And so we just used the power of our passports as well as documenting to create a buffer between the Israeli army, settlers, and the Palestinians. So, yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you very much. So speaking of the buffer, you know, something that I think a lot of people try to use is like Western privilege or international privilege, right? And trying to be buffers. Of course, the question is how much that works, given what happened to Rachel Corrie, Eichner, obviously, who we can talk about. You yourself were shot, luckily not fatally. And not to mention, of course, the countless Palestinians who never make it into the news. But can you talk about what happened to you and how the government, Uncle Sam, responded, given that, you know, Joe Biden has promised that if you hurt an American, there's going to be a response?
That guy. Yeah. Okay, so, me and Liar, we went to the protest. It happens every Friday in Beta. The Palestinians are just trying to get back to their land that a settlement's built on, the Ivitar settlement. And it starts out with a Juma prayer without incident. And then, well, even before we started chanting, the IOF was pointing their guns at us, like 3 to 4 people, soldiers up there. And right after the Juma prayer, that's when they shot tear gas at us. A few more rounds, and then the live rounds started happening. So we hid behind a concrete wall, maybe like 15 of us at that point, 20, and we just waited out some tear gas, some live rounds, see the dust coming off the concrete walls. And then I think the Palestinians thought they were coming closer, so we ran. We ran over a concrete wall, or jumped over a concrete wall, climbed it really. And then we just were far, far in the distance. We kind of came back, had to wait until it was safe because there's Palestinians running down the hill that we were just going up on for the demonstration. And then we were able to go to our right. There was a little coffee break, some duhan, smoke break. So coffee and tea for like 5 minutes. Some Palestinians went to our right, and that was the foot of the, I guess, hill where the IOF were.
And people probably know this, but IOF is Israeli occupation forces instead of calling them the Israeli defense forces. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah. Thank you. And so there's tear gas shot at us, live rounds again. But eventually, there's Palestinians to our left that were running towards us, and then behind us through the olive grove. So going through the olive grove, just making sure my friends were safe, my comrades, the Palestinians. And I think I was the last one going down. And right when I stepped down, that's when I heard a loud bang. And then I thought it was a tear gas canister, because it felt like someone just hit me with a blunt object. I was still running because I didn't want to get shot. And comrade of ours helped me out into the clearing. And then once I was in the clearing, that's when the Palestinians lifted me up, brought me to the pickup truck, and then to the emergency clinic in Beta. Then they transferred me to an ambulance. And then after being blocked by the IOF with their trucks, after two other checkpoints and making sure that, you know, they saw who was inside, finally got to Rafidia Hospital, where I got my care. So.
And how did the U.S. respond to this, your government?
Man. Are they my government? They don't care about
ostensibly
our lives, right? Aishnur's life. So the embassy reached out to me. And so they wanted a report, gave them a report. And then eventually, because I didn't want to go to the, I don't know, it had to be a settlement or go to Israel, you know, 48. So I didn't want to do that. And I also had a limited amount of time. I was healing. I got out of the hospital. So I wrote the report and then stayed in Palestine for the whole period that I decided to for the 2 weeks and left. I didn't want to go and meet them and, you know, be gaslit or what have you. So they sent the report. They said they're going to follow up, give me updates. No updates, except for they sent it. So that's the only update I got from the embassy. When I got here, nothing from the State Department. I think they put out a notice. We are aware of a U.S. citizen shot. We have an advisory that people should not go there, you know. And that was it. So no State Department reached out after that. We had a politician reach out, but I didn't want to meet him unless he was going to meet with Americans for Justice in Palestine, which I lobbied with. And he didn't meet with us. So we talked to the staffer, but I didn't give him my personal information because I wanted him to meet with us, because I don't want him to say some empty sorry. His name is Cory Booker, if y'all know.
Oh, I was going to ask. So. Okay, nice. You're on notice, Cory Booker. Okay.
Yeah. So
big Zionist.
Until he agrees to meet with the group, then I'm not meeting with him. So yeah. But that's the extent of our government's care. Even though Biden said, you know, if you harm a U.S. citizen, we're going to act, right? Whether it was me, Aishnur, we see the inaction. We see the repetition of the lies. Israel said it was a mistake. It was a warning shot. But warning shots go up and down, not through someone's leg. And for Aishnur, the disgusting lie of, oh, it ricked shit off the ground into her head, right? So, yeah, we see how also when IOF soldier was killed, right? They put it all over the news, right? I don't know if he was a hostage, but right, he was touted all over the news. He died, right? But what about Aishnur, right? Another U.S. citizen. So, yeah.
And did you know Aishnur? Did either of you know her?
No, I didn't. It was her second day on the ground.
Right.
It was like just like me, right? My second day on the ground and I was shot. It was her second day.
I heard in an interview that you think that maybe if the U.S. had handled your shooting differently, she would still be alive. Can you just explain what you meant by that? Then I'll bring you this.
Yeah. Yeah, if the U.S. put any pressure on Israel, maybe they would see different change. So when Aishnur was shot and murdered, we saw... from what I heard, they did block off where people were protesting, but there was no tear gas, no live rounds, right? So with that kind of de-escalation, though they're still occupying the land, you know, there's still military presence there where there shouldn't be. You know, for the Palestinians there, right, 17 were murdered since October 7th in Beita. Maybe it would look different, right? Maybe they'd be more cautious in how they roll, but it's not the case, right? Because there was no press coverage when I was shot, and it took someone's death to even have some kind of de-escalation, which I'm sure right now it's going back. I heard that they have, instead of single tear gas canister shooters, right, launchers, they have multiple ones now. So, you know, they'll just slowly ramp back up because they know they can get away with it.
And how does this story and also what you saw in the documentary track with what you experienced and with your analysis? And what do you find the most kind of outrageous and, if anything, surprising?
I don't think anything we're seeing surprises us anymore. I think from my perspective, it's the audacious stuff that they're spreading on their social media platforms, right? It's the stuff that, wow, they're celebrating all the trauma they're causing. They're celebrating a shooting. They don't care because there's no form of accountability. There never has been. You mentioned if your shooting would have helped Aishna, Rachel Corrie, which you mentioned, Shireen, like a journalist was gunned down, an American citizen, and yet nothing done. And the reason I mentioned earlier on the court stuff, it's like when this all started, do you remember Blinken put sanctions on like 10 settlers? Yeah. That's what that court reminded me of. It's like, we're decimating the population of Gaza. We are in the middle of a genocide. The settler stuff is rampant. So Blinken comes out and goes, I'm going to put sanctions on 10 people. It's the theatrics that they mentioned in the documentary around the court appearance, like the theatrics of we're doing something. They had a press conference. They had such a big step. You know, we will not like allow rampant bad behavior in the West Bank. Some of those sanctions have disappeared, by the way. So those people are free to do whatever they want again. So the theatrics of that court is exactly how we act. Israel's modeled on us. Like that violence is modeled on our behavior. The way, one of the most traumatic things I find that is the way they treat children. There's Palestinian kids who they took off and they're going to disappear them. They will be raped, tortured, whatever else. You know, all the worst things you can possibly imagine. And there will be no accountability by our governments for that behavior. Yet we talk about October 7th, which again is great journalists have proven a lot of stuff didn't happen that we've been propagandized by our own media outlets. You mentioned how the IDF officer who died, an IOF officer who died in Gaza, we had the whole like media round on him. Well, recently an Israeli air base was struck by Hezbollah, a military target, and we had all our news channels celebrating that four 19-year-olds who are in the service of their military, but not one of the 2,000-odd people that they killed in Lebanon in a couple of weeks. Right, the propaganda we're fed is mind-blowing because we're supposed to feel humanity for the people perpetrating the most horrific violence known to mankind. This far, and I hate making comparisons, but because it's being televised to us, it's far more gruesome than what we probably know of World War II and what happened, because it's literally being shown off to us. I think a scholar wrote recently that the Nazis hid it for years. They're not, and they haven't hidden since day one. And that's what tracks as well. Even in 2011, they didn't mind beating a child in front of diplomats because they knew the diplomats in that car served the governments that are okay with their occupation. That's the tracking. They know those governments are going to do nothing to hold them accountable. That's why I've said repeatedly in like stuff along this line, the only thing that's going to free Palestinians, the only thing that's going to protect the Lebanese is the resistance. Because our governments have checked out and are going to continue to arm Israel until this ends. The one thing I learned in the West Bank from some Palestinians I got to spend time with is, because the only good thing about those financing projects is I got to directly work with Palestinian families. And the one thing they said is like, you think we feel besieged? It's you that's besieged. We have the land, sea, the air, like we serve God, like we know whatever they give us, we're free. You're not. You're besieged. You're besieged by your own beliefs, your the evil you do in the world. Stuck with me ever since then. And I think someone else has said that a lot better, in Hassan Nasrallah as well, talking about how we are killing ourselves. And the most frightening thing about what we're seeing from me is the impact it's having on everyone, actually. And I really believe the resistance is fighting for humanity at this point. Because do you remember when Drone Obama was bombing everybody and we had a series of drone pilots commit suicide because of the amount of trauma they were seeing? What is this doing to everyone? What is this doing to our world that we're watching these atrocities, watching people burn alive, being bombed? They are transforming our society in front of us. We are being killed. We're besieged. They're free. Even with all of what they're going through, they're free and we're not. And I think some of the stuff in that, one thing, line that always sticks with me is every accusation is a confession. From the beginning, those kids, settler hilltop killers, and it goes beyond them because it's about 80% of Israel that supports this right now, by the way. I think I might be wrong. I'm not sure. And 60-odd% support starvation. All that radical Islam you learned about in the millennium, about how like they teach their kids to hate the world. Well, look, you saw it right there. It's actually the Zionists that do that. You know, all that radical like behavior about they take lives and don't care about families. They burn children. They do all this stuff. They do that. All that behavior that we were propagandized, that like the Al-Qaeda's, all this stuff. I'm not saying the people aren't evil. I'm saying there are just all that stuff we were told to believe about a religion, about a people, about a color, is actually what we do. And the most violent interpretation of that is the Zionist entity that is Israel today. And that is what you see in that documentary. That is what tracks. And that is only difference between what I saw in 2011 is they're broadcasting it. And they don't care because they've never been held accountable by whatever president we've ever had, whether it be Democrat or Republican. I frankly think Republicans have done, you know, that Ronald Reagan call is often brought up. The fact that a Ronald Reagan has done more to hold Israel accountable than Barack Obama, than Bill Clinton and Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and all the Democrat heroes that we've put up on platforms for the last 40 years is a joke. Ronald Reagan.
Call it a Holocaust.
Yes. And they took their tails between the legs and ran back to the South and kept that occupied. Look, we must all remember, like, the one thing that we can do still is disrupt. Like I said, the resistance itself will take care of this. And by the way, they're still only hitting military targets, no matter what our media says. They are literally targeting Israeli media, military. We have to disrupt our governments and our institutions. Look what's happening in Europe right now, right? The government's equally as culpable and of this genocide. But the unions won't dock ships in Italy. The Spanish unions refuse to work with their own government if they send Israel even food, forget alone like military weapons. There are people taking action that is disruptive, and we need to mobilize in a more committed way to put our lives on the line and put more of our own entity at risk, because that's our role in this. We are not going to stop this administration or the next one, whether it's Harris or Trump, from sending weapons. What we can do is disrupt that flow, make it impossible for them to do it peacefully within our own borders, make it impossible for European governments to partner with America to let those weapons get from Shannon in Ireland or wherever else they dock. Make sure people work together across because remember, this is the other thing, it's only the Western countries doing this, by the way. So this whole like the world's on Israel's side. Remember this, from the UN days, literally it's 28 countries. The rest of the world is with Palestine. I never forget that. And I believe our public is with Palestine. The reality is our government and our institutions are doing everything to wait this out so we stop. That's what it is. Sorry, I've gone on.
We're going to talk more about the presidential elections, international questions, also how this is affecting people here. But what about your experiences? How did your experiences in the West Bank compare to what we saw here? And is there anything that you experienced that was particularly disturbing that wasn't captured here that you want people to know about?
Yeah. where do I start? Yeah. I guess I can start with Aishanur. I remember the day she was murdered.
And this, by the way, everyone's on the same page. She was a volunteer, Turkish American. Yes. They kept emphasizing that.
Yeah.
And she was murdered in the West Bank. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
While volunteering.
She was volunteering in Beita, which is the same place where Daniel got shot in the leg. And I had attended a few weeks as well. That week, I decided to stay home, and some other volunteers went and were on the ground with her when she was shot. But you know what the scale of the violence, like, and how kind of pervasive it is, I think is hard to like convey to people. Like, and the same day that we got news that she had been shot and was getting driven to the hospital, the village of Kariut near us was being raided by settlers at the exact same time. And we could see the smoke from the attack. And at that moment, a 12-year-old girl named Bana Amjad was shot in her home by a soldier. He shot through the window from down the street. And I went to that funeral after that. And that, you know, it's just like abysmal, kind of the pervasiveness of the violence.
And that didn't make headlines.
No, exactly. And again, that's the thing of like, to them, to Zionism, it's in the Zionist ideology that the Palestinians are supposed to die or leave. Like, there's no in between. That part where the guy was like, oh, we're just trying to live a normal life here in the settlements. I'm like, no, you're not. It's disgusting. You know, they mentioned Esh Kodesh, we would keep watch on Esh Kodesh every night. I would look at Esh Kodesh for 5 weeks because we were on the other side of it. Duma was on the other side. But on August 30th, settlers convened in Esh Kodesh and raided the village where we were staying of Kusra. And you know, it's the only thing I can compare it to is the KKK. It's like a paramilitary. It's a gang of people masked up. They come in, they burn property, they kill livestock, they just cause havoc, and they're always supported by the IOF. Once the army shows up, you know, they don't help, they don't arrest the settlers. Any court thing, as you mentioned, is like a circus. It's like for show. And one instance that sticks out is that day on August 30th of the settler attack, after the settlers had left, the soldiers were still moving through the village. And there was a little boy named Zed who liked to hang out with the volunteers. And we would see him at the playground. And he had just said hi to us as we were kind of running around trying to film stuff. And they had pushed the volunteers back further into town. And one of Zed's friends told him to come, like, walk, come inside the store. There's like a store at an intersection, like, for safety. And soldiers were there and they saw him walking into the store and they shot him through both legs with one bullet, just cause. And so, and that was after the attack, you know. So they do this just because they can. Again, there's no consequences. They do this with impunity. And so whether it's the volunteers or obviously the Palestinians themselves deal with this first and foremost, but if there was any pressure on the occupation, like, this would be over. But there's no accountability from any of the Western governments.
Can I just add quickly, did you notice that Palestinians are just built over their land because historically they've been there forever and all the settlements are on militarily superior points? That is literally the difference. They are a military entity by even the settlers themselves, who are like looking for strategic hill points so they can come down and attack, where like Palestinians are just trying to live. Like, it's so visible even in their own words, right? Where they literally say, oh yeah, we're looking for strategic points so we can raid towns. Like, it's designed that way. It's designed like how we would like go on the Crusades. We'd find military points to like attack the local people who live there. And that's everything you're seeing in that documentary.
It also reminded me of the way you brought up the KKK. And of course, it made me think of the collaboration between the KKK and the police that we saw. So this is, you know, the parallel with the military and the settlers, the terrorists. Of course, they're not called terrorists and they're not considered terrorists. And Blinken did look into sanctioning a group and then dropped it. He just literally dropped it. He couldn't even do that. He couldn't even do a superficial optics-based punishment. But I was wondering if, I mean, it, obviously there's a profound and disturbing and unforgivable lack of accountability, and there's a profound impunity. But did you get the sense from Palestinians you met that your presence did provide any level of safety or any buffer?
Yeah, from the Palestinians we were with, it did. They told us once volunteers started arriving that the violence in the village where we were placed was like de-escalate as much as you can de-escalate in an occupation. Like, but it did decrease. It calmed things down to the point where people were like, you know, where are the settlers? And then, you know, our like coordinator was like, what, do you miss them? Like, and so they're, you know, it's important. And, but I recognize as a volunteer, it's a band-aid kind of to a much larger issue, but it did at least, it does give them some breathing room and allow them to farm. We spent a lot of time shepherding. I would go with a shepherd through all these places. I recognize the settlements a lot, like Shiloh, because it's by a village called Jalud that we would go with the shepherd and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, and basically that's how they make their livelihood. Every aspect of their life is controlled by the occupation, right? So for instance, after October 7th, a lot of people didn't have jobs. And so you either have to go and work in 48, which some people do, or I don't know, you figure something out. That's kind of the economic squeeze to try to get people to leave as well. But their livelihood is shepherding, olive harvest, figs, all of that stuff that's tied to the land is really crucial to them. And that's kind of the only thing that the occupation leaves them to do, but not really, because again, they're always trying to encroach and kick people out and burn farms and this kind of stuff. So I don't know if I answered the question. I kind of went on a tangent, but
yeah, ditto. Because I was shot, I wasn't able to do the shepherding and everything. But I wanted to with the farmers as well. You know, I was just keeping watch. I did a first aid training there. But one thing that we were able to do, which was not your most favorite thing, the park. So the garden. they said that it wasn't open until international volunteers came. And that was my favorite part. So that was where all the kids came. We were dancing. I was dancing in my crutches. And it was just like this beautiful like Eden in the midst of all this chaos, right? And the kids were just smiling, singing, learning kung fu, right? Yeah, a little bit. You know, gossiping with the other volunteers. And it was just really beautiful. And they weren't able to do that beforehand, right? So just our presence allowed them to feel safe enough to open up the playground again. And the organizations that do that, right? FAZA, we were with, so that's FAZ3A_PAL or defendpalestine.org. And then Aishnor was part of ISM, International Solidarity Mission. So those are the two organizations that are down there. We're in different areas, but we work together and we support each other too. So, yeah.
And what were the soldiers like and what were the settlers like towards you and also, of course, towards the Palestinians?
The soldiers on early, if they thought we were tourists, they kind of tried to do their like kind of safety, like duty to keep us safe or whatever. So I remember one instance we were out with the shepherd and I was showing the new volunteers how to accompany the shepherd. And then we saw a drone flying overhead. And then about 5-10 minutes later, army jeeps pulled up and this soldier came up, introduced himself and was like, hey, we're just here to let you know this area is not safe. And they're all strapped with M16s and grenades. And I'm like, why is it not safe? You might have something to do with that. you know, so but in their head, they view Arabs, Palestinians always that like terrorists, and everything in their head is like for defending what they think belongs to them, right? And so that was the most polite interaction I had, of him trying to tell me like, hey, this area is not safe. The army raided the village we were in multiple times. They would fire tear gas. They would fire sound grenades. The jeeps would roll into town and fire all that stuff. Come in and fire live ammunition. So I see what the occupation does in practice. So like when they try to put on like a nice face to it, I'm just like, okay, whatever, get out of here. The only interaction I had with settlers was when they raided the village. So like we never went into anywhere near the settlements. The village where we were is actually surrounded by 6 settlements. So it's nearly surrounded. And on one side, the head settler of a settlement called Migdalim actually he bulldozed the road and placed a gate, large gate, that cuts off the Palestinians from a major highway. So for instance, when we would go to Beta, it takes about 30-40 minutes because we have to take like these longer routes. But if that highway was available for Palestinians, it would be like a 5-10 minute drive. And then we started doing demonstrations at that gate. And then the army basically same thing. They would pull up, they wouldn't give any comment, they wouldn't say anything. They would wait around for an hour while we filmed them, and then they would talk to the mayor or someone and say, you guys got 5 minutes to leave. Otherwise, we'll use tear gas and bullets. And that was the standard like interaction basically with the occupation.
Joe Biden released a statement yesterday declaring 1 year ago today, 6-year-old Wadi Al-Fayoumi, an American Muslim boy of Palestinian descent, was brutally killed in his family's home. We must work to stand united in support of all Americans, no matter their race or religion. There is no place for hate in America. So I wanted to ask you actually your thoughts on Biden's statement, because you obviously you were not killed. I mean, sorry, that sounded really weird. You were not gravely injured. You were not gravely injured, but you were targeted. I would say you were the victim of a hate crime that luckily did not have a large physical impact on you. But can you explain what happened to you? And then I'm going to ask you about this.
Yes. So on November 7th, so it's nearly a year, me and my toddler at the time, he was only 18 months, were targeted by an Israeli American.
And you were wearing a keffiyeh.
I was wearing my keffiyeh. It's 1 month into the Gaza onslaught, and we're in a playground, and I won't go through the whole story, but basically she started with, we're Hamas, we're terrorists, we don't belong here, you and your son don't belong here, you're both terrorists, and basically went on and on and on. And you know, I've heard all the hate language in the past in general, and I, you know, anyone who has a kid knows that, like, especially at a playground, like, like, what is going on here? Like, I didn't have time to even think politically, given that's my background. Like, what am I going to say to this person? I didn't have my phone on me because it was with the stroller. So I went back. She's still berating me from the middle of this basketball court. She told me my people were dogs and that your people burn babies in an oven. And I hope someone burns yours, a baby in an oven. And then I was like, I need to get my phone. So I thought, like a normal human being, no one wants to be on camera doing something worse or saying any of these things. So I put my phone up and she got worse. So feels very similar to what we're seeing in Gaza. But she carried on berating me, but then walked over and I had my son in my arms at this point. She threw her phone, like your iPhone. Now, this might hurt you and me if it hits me, but if it hits the side of a toddler's head, it could probably put them in hospital. Seriously. She threw a phone at my son. I put him down behind me. And as I'm coming up, she threw what I learned later I thought was coffee, but it was hot tea at where he was. So she actually tried to burn my son. She hit me a few times and the rest is history. But, you know, where do I start? Some of that documentary is very like, oh, burning children. You know, the famous propaganda that you've heard around October 7th, Hamas burnt people alive, is not true. Actually, it comes from a 1948 incident where Israeli soldiers literally put a baby in an oven and made the family watch. Like, that's what they're referring to. when they say that accusation. That is what they have actually even made a documentary on the soldiers that did that, and they're celebrated in Israel. So that is what happened to me on November 7th. So the parallels of something I worked on. And I want to say the only reason they got coverage, see, that kid got coverage for a day when it originally happened. Even the three Palestinian boys that were shot up in Vermont, coverage for a week. You know, I think Eamon did an amazing interview with them. But I think the only reason my got coverage is, one, I'm British. I'm not Palestinian. I was the Middle East peace envoy. One of his chief advisors at one point. And I think the media in New York could not get their head around that that happened in a New York playground to someone who did that. And the fact that it happened to my toddler. All of that combined is the reason it got coverage. If Palestinian entered any of that, I think it might have made the news for a day, but disappeared.
And you said during your interviews, and then you said to me when I interviewed you on my show, that you said you blame Joe Biden for that. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I know it's a simplistic thing to say, but he is the head of our government, and he has created an environment where Palestinian Arabs and brown people who might look like that are targets. It's very reminiscent of 9/11.
And the first person killed was a Sikh person.
Guy. Yeah, so after 9/11, a lot of people know that a Sikh guy was targeted, his turban was ripped off, and he was killed, tragically beaten. And actually, weirdly, the first person after Gaza to get, again, most people don't even know this has happened. Before that kid got killed was a Sikh guy in Queens again. The parallels are so similar. Like, he was beaten to death, dragged out of his car and beaten to death. And they didn't call it a hate crime until the community started protesting. And it took that long. Then Wadi happened. Then we happened. And still, the only reason I believe we got coverage was all the factors of my background that went into this.
And meanwhile, there was a Jewish woman who was tragically killed, and had nothing to do with Israel, but she was killed. And right away, the headlines were about how it was a hate crime, and it happened to be totally unrelated to her Jewish identity. But.
Yeah, 100%. And when I hear Biden's statement, one, he didn't do that last year when that happened. So when it happened, he didn't do that. When those boys in Vermont, he hasn't called them. Americans were shot, like, and survived, but the shot. It's a hate crime.
One is paralyzed.
Didn't call them. Like, the president calls. This is Mr. Hug every shooter victim ever, like, at schools. Like, we all remember those images from the 2020 election where he basically said, I'm the caring president. Didn't matter who you were. He would hug you. The White House loved putting those images out when Obama was president. You know, Biden would be the guy who'd, like, go to the scene. He's not calling anyone. And the commonality is they're all brown, they're all Arab, or they're Palestinian. That's why he doesn't care. And that's when the head of your government behaves that way, and that's why I say it's Biden's fault, then everything else topples beneath that. Government, staff, and society to a degree. Like, yes, people do care about these victims, but obviously the media's not covering it, so they don't even know there's victims in the first place. And the president doesn't really give a shit about them.
And also, he perpetuates atrocity propaganda. And we know that the first time of many, I think he did it three times, the beheaded babies, but the first time he brought that up, his staff told him it wasn't confirmed. Mm-hmm. He did that again and again. You brought up the rape stories, which, again, there was an entire, like, media industry dedicated to the mass rape hoax, I would say, the alleged Hamas mass rape. It was constantly in newspapers. Obviously, the New York Times did something on it. Dana Bash said, when Pramila Jayapal brought up the number of civilians killed back in December, Dana Bash of CNN, her response was literally, well, that's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping Palestinian women.
Even though it's well documented.
Yeah. I mean, and then no one has ever apologized for that.
No.
No one has ever corrected the record on that. And yet, we know from Israeli media, because they can be more honest, because they don't have to whitewash it for their own audience. We know from Israeli media that, and I'm not speaking about the systemic rape and sexual violence that we know is endemic. Mm. And we know from Josh Paul, who worked at the State Department, that the State Department brought to Israel these claims from a 13-year-old prisoner who said he had been raped during an interrogator. During interrogation, and the response from the Israeli government was to shut down the charity that had brought his case forward.
Yeah.
But then fast forward to now, when we see on Israeli television a gang rape of a Palestinian soldier. We learn that he's taken to the hospital, has internal injuries. Then when police show up to arrest some of these soldiers, there's a protest for what has been deemed the right to rape. And then you have a member of the Knesset saying that it's, quote, legitimate to, quote, insert sticks into people's rectums. And where is the media coverage of this? So how is that not, like, don't you have to at least pretend? Like, we know you don't care about them, but can't you at least pretend that you care about rape and sexual violence, no matter who it happens to? But, you know, this inversion, like you were saying earlier, there's this trope of the Muslim, the brown person, the Arab, you know, people use those terms interchangeably, even though they're not, but doesn't value life. You hear this a lot. They don't value life. They want to be martyrs. They want their children to die. That's why you can't deal with them. They want to kill all Jews. And it's just so striking to see these Israeli Zionist settlers burn a house, kill a baby, and not just that, but then joke about him being on the grill. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who claim that the savage Palestinian Arab wants to kill all Jews, mm-hmm. and that Jews just want to, you know, are these enlightened people who would love to live in peace. And it's you know, same thing with Hezbollah gets tall terrorists. I mean, look at the civilian body count of Hezbollah versus the IAOF. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's absolutely obscene.
I mean, they literally flew a drone into the military base to hit their targets. And Israel has the most advanced weapon in the world. It's like insane. It's not even a secret that they're at this point.
And something else I was thinking about was how horrible it was that that woman said to you that, what did she say about your, he wanted, about burning
him? She wants to burn, this. Well, she says, your people burn babies in ovens. So I hope someone burns your baby in an oven. Then she proceeds to try and do it. So
with a hot beverage. Yeah. So, you know, just thinking about that, thinking about what they said about Ali being on the grill, thinking about how they burned these people alive. And of course, what just happened the other day where we see these, I mean, I don't know. It's very hard to look at those images and also to see this boy who was killed, this 19-year-old. There are videos of him explaining that they're looking for fundraising to get out of Gaza and try to get through Egypt. And he, I believe, built the tent that he and his family were in. And it's just, you see footage of him literally burning alive. And I keep thinking of, like, all the lessons that were supposed to be taken away. And this is a whole other conversation, but in theory, we're supposed to be taken away from the Holocaust. Like, never again, can we stand and idly by while this is being done. And it just, no, we can't, people do that.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, I guess to leave on hopefully we can find some hope, like what can be done? What organizing work needs to be done? Let me start with a different question first. Not as hopeful. Does it matter who's elected in November, by the way, on this issue?
I mean, I don't think you should vote for either of them, but like, I mean, take what's happened with the uncommitted thing. I'm going to take one step back quickly. That's become a farce. But the guys who are running it, famous Democrat strategists, their whole goal was to get jobs in the White House and the Democrat Party institutions. And, you know, they dragged this organic movement along who felt betrayed, who are now starting their own thing, separate from the Democrat strategists that kind of led that. They also probably taken the money that was raised for that, which is a joke. Like, so I think people need to do what they feel right for their conscience. I think if you want to vote green, go vote green. If you don't want to vote, don't vote. Our administrations, the two that can win right now, are not going to change anything. What we need to do is the organizing parts, which I know we're going to talk about next, but that either of them are going to continue what's going on. Harris is guilty as sin. Like, there's no question about it, right? She's in the war cabinet. Do you know what's so arrogant about all this? I have a famous deck of cards out there. The only reason I could name all the US war cabinet is because the White House published it going, we're going to support Israel with this war cabinet. And they're making all the decisions. They published it last November because they literally named all the people in their roles, right? Harris is one of them. And if you think anything, if you think her fake joy and staged shit is going to get her through, through this, nothing is, her husband's a Zionist. They own property in the West Bank, I think, by association.
They serve wine at something from the West
Bank. That's from the West Bank, stolen. And also the other thing with her advisors, if we think Blinken and Co are bad, they're the same group. I mean, this sickness about how they feel about Palestinians and their land stems throughout the entire institution of the State Department, who they would take as advisors if Blinken's whole crew got moved on. So it doesn't change with her. Trump, I think the interesting thing for me is, like, does he pull a fast one on everyone? Like, I don't think you should vote for him. I think he's horrible. I'm just saying he did move the Jerusalem embassy, but is that comparable to what Biden's doing today? No, I'm not advocating for him. I just think he's just more unpredictable, but he's not going to end this genocide. That's what I'm saying. Harris is guilty of sin and will continue the policy. Trump's just out of control. So we don't know what he's going to do.
It was interesting during the debate when Biden said something about how, you know, Israel doesn't want to fight. The only one who wants to fight is Hamas. And Trump, in his moment of who said it, Trump or Chomsky, which is a game I like to play, he was like, what are you talking about? Of course Israel wants to keep fighting. And you're like, oh, he's honest. He's like, and they should finish the job, which is so Trump. It's like he tells the truth and is absolutely morally reprehensible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
these,
I think the interesting thing for me is, like, if all of this was happening under Trump, everyone would be protesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean some people are, truth. But more people. More like, people the but Trump people would be protesting.
Yes, 100%.
Instead, they're brunching. So what are your thoughts on that? And then we're going to talk about what is to be done. And maybe we have time for like two questions at the end.
Okie dokie. So what is to be done? I think it's to everyone's capacity, right? The highest thing I feel like you can do, if you're able to financially, mentally, you know, physically, is to go to Palestine yourself. To go through, you know, to provide protective presence, whether it's, you know, through FASA, whether it's through ISM. You know, if you're even interested, you can just do orientation and, like, figure it out if you can or not, right? You don't have to do it, like, in a week or two or a month, right? People are planning to go, like, in February, right? Some people are actually leaving, like, what's today? Tuesday? Yeah, so every Wednesday, every other Wednesday, people go. So, yeah, so that's the highest. But if you can't, right, you can fund those trips, right? If you have the money. So if you go to defendpalestine.org, if you go to FAS3A_PAL, right, you can get connected to how to fund those trips for folks that do want to go. There's a Palestinian that actually wanted to go, and I think they're on their way there or helping them fund. So, you know, someone going back to their land, right, is beautiful, right? Also, a push is at PalShield. PalShield is trying to provide defensive things for the Palestinians. That's fire extinguishers, that's gas masks, that's helmets, vests, right? No offensive things, but, right, just for the town to be secure, right? CCTV even. So that's in the town that we were in, Kusra. So that's a big thing. So at PAL Shield, that's where you'll find that. So those two things are really big. But right, presidential election, you know, either way, it's gonna look similar. We've seen the atrocities happen under Trump, under Biden especially, and Harris will continue that, right? We're in New York. I'm from Jersey. We're not a swing state. So if you feel like this conscious thing of, oh, but the swing vote, you can vote your conscience. Also, local elections, right? Because there's some people that are signing off on these, right? Arms being sent, right? More locally, that we have a little bit more say in. But that's not the end all be all, right? There's anti-imperialist organizations, pro-Palestinian organizations that, you know, you join. There's power in numbers, right? Individually, we can, you know, be on social media, we can share, and those are things are important, right? Visibility. But joining up with anti-imperialist organizations, right? PYM, Wool, coming here to People's Forum, doing like the education here. I did Revolutionary Summer School and then I went to Palestine, so I couldn't finish it, right? These are all things that that we can do, right? Being organized, being with other people will, you know, push your education further on, you know, Palestine, on what's happening around the world, right? I learned that in the Philippines, we're like the fifth largest buyer of weapons from Israel, right? So we can see the connections in all of our different struggles. You know, the NYPD is trained by the IDF, right? IOF, right? A lot of them, or some of them. So, you know, it's all interconnected. So finding the interconnections within all of our communities, coming together, organizing, that's where the power lies, right? It can start with a film screening that you do for your friends. And then you find organizations, create your own, and we can see a different world, and we can create it here, alternate world, and one day when we hopefully dismantle this corrupt system, because we see both sides doing the same thing, committing genocide and profiteering off war, that's where we can kind of showcase that, you know, a new world is being built, right, by us, right, and like-minded people.
Yeah, just I want to echo Daniel's sentiment. I think if you're able to and willing to go, you should volunteer. They desperately need more people. That's all they said. You know, they when it was my time to go home, they didn't want me to go home. Everyone said, like, no, don't leave, stay till olive harvest, this kind of stuff. So they're always very appreciative of people that come and stand in solidarity with them. And, you know, even if they had like 100 more volunteers, it still wouldn't be enough. But, you know, so every person counts. So I do want to say and just kind of put the call out. If you're able to go, you should go with whatever organization works for you. As far as the election, it's bipartisan support for the Zionist project. So personally, I'm going to be honest, I'm not going to vote this time around, but everyone can, you know, feel whatever, do whatever you feel is right. But I can't support either candidate.
What about a non-Democrat or Republican?
I'll think about it. I'll see.
But yeah. I'm curious, and then I'll pass the mic, obviously, but do you know if the killing of Eichner and the shooting of your shooting, which basically I think really was publicized more after Eichner was killed, right? That kind of put that whole phenomenon on the map. Do you know if people then, they get more volunteers or fewer volunteers? Do you know if the numbers went up or down?
So I've just literally every event or interview that's thrown at me, I try my best to make it work. Because this was given to me from Beta. I wanted to go to the demonstration the week after. They're like, no, you're on crutches, man. And I'm like, no, I want to go. And then they honored me with this, right? So after learning Eichner died, I continued to use it. Sometimes inside I don't need it, but like I still use it, especially on long walks, to remind myself, you know, to be a vessel, to be able to serve the movement by sharing the stories of all the people I've met in Palestine, of Eichner, that was standing in solidarity with the Palestinians, right? So I've done podcasts, interviews, events, and I've heard actually from our people that they get like a couple inquiries every day because of my podcast. I forget, there's so many things I've done. There was one in Brooklyn that people really enjoyed. I met someone in DC and was like, I heard you on the podcast, man. And someone at a protest said the same thing. So I try my best to just do every event I can, every interview, because that'll just reach one more person that will either be able to donate, will be able to go, be inspired to go. Even like friends that like were non-political, like from high school or middle school, they're like, because of you, I want to speak out, right? So it goes from the people that just are now starting to speak up to people that, you know, are able to go, to people that can donate as well. So yes, it's working because people have seen the sacrifice of Eichner, and then also seeing that, you know, I'm still continuing on with telling the stories of, you know, Palestine, that, you know, they are inspired to as well. So, yeah.
And what is your prognosis for your recovery?
I have to go to the doctor. I've been teaching, man. It's so hard you know, like just balance everything with interviews and events. But, you know, and calling out of work for certain things. But I can walk pretty well. I've gone to the marches. But I just don't know if I can run or bike yet. So I just have to like talk to the doctor. It feels good, but I don't really know yet.
He's downplaying how lucky he is. So the bullet entered the leg here and came out here, but it missed the bone and it missed the femoral artery. So he's like you're incredibly lucky. Probably like the luckiest dude I've ever met.
If it had hit the femoral artery, I mean,
I'd be dead.
Gone, right? You'd be gone. Like, because they didn't, it's not like they had people like the life-saving, right? But I assume it wouldn't have been easy to get to a.
Yeah, I mean, with the hospital. With the checkpoints and the blocking us from getting to the hospital. If that was the case, within that time frame, I'd probably have died. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, and again, we're like speaking from relative places of extreme relative privilege. You know, it's just, I mean, even with your that you got shot, you could have been killed. But again, we're just reminded that buffer or that luxury that you have is something that, you know, Palestinians don't have. It's just so stunning to remember sometimes. I can't, like, I don't know. I feel like I find myself numb. I'm constantly reaching a new state where it requires something else to wake me out of it. Not indifferent numb, but just like in order to function numb. So what do you think is the most encouraging thing that we can do? And also, as someone who has worked for the devil, for various devils, right? Because what do you got? Blair, Boris Johnson, Obama. It's okay. It's a safe space. We believe in rehabilitation. What is it that keeps the West so loyal to Israel? And how does that shape what we can do about it?
Well, the first thing, I think people need to advocate for the resistance. This isn't like a crime. Again, I go back to one thing, 28 countries. Some are flaking, by the way. The Irish and Spanish are about to come off that "we believe they're terrorist" list. So that's going to reduce the number of people that actually believe this. It's a list, by the way, that's used to control like us, frankly, more than anything else. It's a list to like make us afraid to talk about things like liberation and freedom and everything else. We,
UK, yeah, they're arresting people.
They arrest people for literally having like parachute Hamas fire sweatshirts and put them under terror charges. Like the laws that they have passed since the Patriot Act here in the UK and Germany and everything. Germany is mind-blowing. To stop conversation about this, you always have to remember that the majority of the world, like you just take the UN countries that are recognized, over 160 plus think these groups are freedom fighters. They're actually legitimate occupational, the resistance to any form of occupation. That's, you need to advocate for them. And I know that sounds scary, but they used to call Nelson Mandela a terrorist. They used to call the IRA. By the way, here's the fuckeries with the IRA, right? People here would fund the IRA, by the way.
Republicans a lot.
And yeah, they would fund the IRA. They were still, though, on our terror list. So let's just be clear how messed up our politics is, right? Well, on one hand, we're like the terrorists because our allies are the Brits, but we're also underhandedly funding them because their other allies were the Irish. So like,
Peter King of Long Island.
That is true. But like we have a history, and I'd love someone to actually ask Matt Miller this question one day, that horrible devil on a podium, you know, have we ever made a mistake?
Count Smirkula.
Could you, you know, you're standing up there and you're talking about Hamas, the terrorists, Hezbollah, terrorists. We've inherently backed the wrong side a lot in our recent history, from Pinochet in Chile to the occupation of South Africa by the apartheid regime to like helping the French retain their authority over Algeria. Every time we were on the wrong side. We are on the wrong side again. So you as the State Department are on the wrong side. You are guilty of being on the wrong side for the last 40 years of everything. And if we want to believe you, you recently lied about something called WMDs. Like, so it's not like we should not be scared to advocate for people fighting for not just the freedom of Palestinians and Lebanese. They are fighting for our collective health and freedom. Because on the other side of this new normal happens here. It already happens here. Look at the cop cities being built. Black kids being shot. More black kids under Biden, by the way, have been shot under Biden than under Trump. If you want another fact not to vote for this current administration. In the 3 years, can't do the fourth year because it's not finished yet, but in the 3 years, more black boys have been shot under President Biden than President Trump. But when it was happening under Trump, Biden would say, what the fuck is going on? What's happening under him? This is our new normal, and they want to make it normal. And I'll tell you another thing that's scary. Everyone used to talk about when drones were going over Iraq, how that would never happen here. The NYPD have drones up here every day. There is now a military contract with a couple of police departments to have armed drones. So if you think what you see in Gaza is not going to happen here, it's happening. You just don't see it. It's happening right now. It's boomeranging right back. That is our future unless we resist. So advocate for the resistance. In terms of what else you can do, they've already said all the things I think in a righteous way you should do. You should go there and put your body on the line if you can. But here, you can take direct action too. Marching is important. It really, the solidarity is important for people in Gaza and the West Bank and Palestine and Lebanon. But it's time we took some real action against our institutions. Like, firstly, everyone responsible should never know a day's peace, ever. And that extends to their families. Someone told me this the other day, oh, but their families have nothing to do with that. Well, do the kids in Gaza have anything to do with what you think are war crimes?
Like, yeah, we're not advocating killing them or maiming them.
We're asking them to be harassed.
You know, harass them.
If they're having dinner,
there should be cost.
There should be cost to that. They should not be welcome in any public institution. They should be washed out of society like they never existed. But at the same time, look, international lawyers, what the hell are you doing? I work with loads of you. And I've been working with loads of people in this field for ages. Take some risks. Their biggest fear is the case will never see the light of day. I mean, there's hundreds of you. You throw hundreds of cases against Biden, Netanyahu, and using something called universal jurisdiction. You don't have to rely on the ICC or the ICJ. You can actually do it in a domestic court anywhere that sees the ICC as a credible court. So a lot of countries in Europe and are signed up to this thing that allows them to prosecute international war crimes in their domestic court. There are lawyers doing nothing. Do something. Like you literally, if I could go to law school now in 2 months and train and do it myself, I would do it. But like we all know that takes years. So you have the ability to do it wherever you are in the world, do it. So what if a judge throws it out? That judge will be hounded. Could you imagine a judge in Spain right now who throws out a case against Netanyahu with the way the Spanish public feels about this? That judge would never know a day's peace, right? If that happened in Ireland, a judge would never know a day's peace. Throw everything you have at it. And for the public, direct action. We've hit our limits of what peaceful protests are going to do. They're not listening. You need to disrupt the flow. And that involves the economy, right? We've talked about BDS against Israel. That should be a foregone conclusion at this point. Everything associated with Israel should be boycott, sanctioned, all of that, right? If everyone in this country stopped connecting to any product that came out of Israel, they're already kind of bankrupt already. Haifa is a port, is shut down. The resistance is also evacuating mass towns that ship out stuff from Israel. This is already happening. We should stop buying. And then we should work on our own economy. They're not going to listen unless the dollar gets affected. And I think a black actress said this recently in an awards show. The white man never listened until it affected his pocket. And that's what needs to happen. We need to impact our economy to the point where it actually breaks their stubbornness to continue this barrage.
So one or two questions and then, And then I guess, come up to the mic. So I saw you a while ago.
This is a very, actually kind of painful question. But because I never thought I would be asking such a thing, but is it possible that because Trump is running on an anti-war platform, take that for whatever it is. That's what his base. That's what so many people that I know who were Democrats are now voting for him specifically because they are anti-war and they think that that's what he's going to be delivering. Is it possible that he is pro-Israel as he is, that he would be potentially try to promise his base to not be funding the war, which is his whole thing is, I'm not going to be funding these wars. I'm going to bring this money back to America. It's painful to even consider that because that's not who I, you know, it's not, but I'm just wondering if there's between the lesser of two evils, if there's a possibility of that and what you would think about it.
His base is anti-war for sure. It's America first, right? It is like they can't, I mean, by again, talk about political mishaps, hurricanes and our current administration sending billions abroad and not helping people with hurricanes in our country. And Trump is totally taking advantage of that, rightly so. He's out on the scene and so is Vance and everyone else. And they're like, well, we're sending billions abroad. They focus on Ukraine. Obviously, they never really focus on Israel, but they do make the valid point to mobilize that base. I still think he's funding Israel, right? That's not, you know, his massive donor is Miriam, what's her name? Adelson. She wants the whole West Bank. Like, I think he's not going to stop. I think he'll get more resistance from his base than the Democrat base, which is like crazy to think. But I think if this like base that's promised no more boots on the ground abroad and they start seeing it again, there'll just be a bit more resistance, but he's not going to not do it. I don't want to put that false impression out there that Trump's going to, and it's, and I know that's not what you're implying, but he's doing what the continuation of what this hawkish Republican Democrat cohort want to do. It's just his base might get a bit angrier about it and be like, you're supposed to be spending money on us. Like, they're a really weird makeup for what we believe are traditional Republicans. They're anti-war. They actually want healthcare, unlike, you know, corporate Republicans. It's complex. I remember really early when DeSantis was still running, he had one of his talks and people were shouting out, why are we sending weapons to kill kids abroad? They were shouting that at DeSantis at a MAGA rally. Like, so like the base is definitely, maybe I don't believe they all care about people abroad, but it's about where the money is going for them for sure. But I just don't see him moving away from his biggest donor. Primarily, that's the biggest thing.
Yeah. Also, we know he famously said that he was going to drain the swamp and then had like John Bolton in his, you know, who was like the biggest hawk. So, I mean, if it would be great if he at all stuck to his promises, but I think he's not going to. And I think with Israel, especially, there's like no difference between the two candidates.
Thank you for doing this. My name is Khaled. I'm Palestinian American, live in Jersey. And a lot of that stuff in that documentary, I've witnessed myself. I mean, I left many, many years ago. But the thing is, like in the last few months, I've been really, I'm devastated. I just don't know. Like even I go to work, I don't smile as much as I used to. And it's just impacting me a lot. And I'm like, not a young guy anymore. Like, you know, I can take it when I'm older, but it's still impacting me. Like, I feel like weak. I just don't know what else I can do. I'm active. I do a lot of things, you know, with AMP in New Jersey, American Muslims for Palestine, and we do a lot of protests. But I feel like what I'm doing, it's not making any change. It's not, I mean, I do boycott. I do, like, every time I buy something, I read the label. I make sure, I work in IT, so people ask me what computer I buy. I say, make sure not HP, for example. Because, you know, HP is one of on the boycott list. So I make sure I make that recommendation. But the question about the mass rape and beheading babies, just last week, I was walking in on Broadway in downtown, and I see three trucks, digital trucks, you know, the anniversary of October 7th, and pro-Israel trucks, pro-Zionism. And they have the lies on the truck, like, you know, raping Israeli woman. A year later, even though it was proven to be a lie, they still make that lie. I mean, I don't understand, like, what can we do? Like, the mainstream media is not, like Kamala Harris, just in her debate with Trump, she mentioned that the rape.
Yeah.
And she's supposed to be our president, or she wants to be the president. What can we do? What else can we do? I mean, we don't have the mainstream media on our side. I know, Katie's, I listen to your show all the time, and I appreciate that. I have it on Bluetooth and I watch it in the train. So that's how I know about this event, by the way. So, but you talk about it, you know, other shows talk about it, but we need to do more to make sure this lie is not spread anymore. They still talk about it. Every time they talk about October 7th, they mention the mass rape of Israeli woman and they mention beheading babies. So,
Do you know why the rape thing is the thing they've stuck with? The reason the rape thing is the reason they've stuck with is, do you remember Super Predators?
Yeah.
Like, who came up with that? The Clintons. Yeah. Right? They know, quote unquote, the innocent white woman being attacked by, in this case, Arabs, but like in that case, black men, is a way to dehumanize an entire population. It's a tried and tested trope to show that they're violent, and it's the accusation confession thing. We do that, actually. Like, that's what we actually do. Bill Clinton was a super predator. You know, like the whole narrative around that, and the why some of the other lies have dropped. They stopped talking about the bed, except Biden. Like, everyone else has stopped talking about it. They stopped talking about, to a degree, the burnt bodies. Only people like Piers Morgan bring that one up. But the rape's important to them because it's the ultimate form of trauma that can be caused to the white population, that the barbarians would come and rape our women. And that's why it sticks with them. We need to just keep communicating that it's a lie and have no shame in it. Don't even debate. I often don't want to debate as Zionists, but even if they bring it up, just it's all untrue. They'll call you conspiracy theorist, crazy. They'll say you don't listen to women. Just, yes, anti-Semitic, but you've got to just stick by the truth because that's the only thing we've got on our side, because the reality is, yes, you're right, CNN, BBC, everyone, they are parroting that lie because it's maintaining this barbarism element to a whole population out in Palestine.
Also, I think another thing is that there's obviously that trope of the, you know, the savage brown or black man. But there's also the trope of Israel being a, you know, peace-loving, democracy-loving society that would never commit sexual violence against women. I think that a useful thing to do is just say, you don't have to believe me, just look at Israeli media. They have the video of someone. Now, the soldiers and the guy they're raping is behind something. You can't see it, but Israeli media reports on that video as being evidence of a gang rape. You can say, don't believe me, listen to the member of the Knesset who said, in defense of people accused of rape, he said it's legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums. Then you can say, I think if you kind of can chip away at people's, like, you can break the spell a little bit. I also think a really useful thing to bring up for people, especially for people who unfortunately are, you know, racist, Jewish supremacists who don't really care about Palestinians dying, I think a good tool for them is to talk about the Hannibal Doctrine, the Hannibal Directive, which says, you know, kill your own people's hostages, kill your own hostages so that they don't get taken away, so you don't have to trade, you know, negotiate. And that, again, I think the reason that's effective is because it kind of shakes the core of people who were born and raised to think that Israel cares about Jewish life. Like, we all know they don't care about Palestinians, but they don't even do that one thing. Like, they had one job. You know, obviously it's not the safest place for Jews, you know, because they keep saying it's the biggest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, which is not an appropriate analogy for many reasons. We get into that in another show. But I do think that that's a useful thing to do, like just kind of get people to question everything. And with a few of those things, and if you're like, look, we don't, there has not been a single person who has claimed that they were raped on October 7th. But what we do know is that someone, a Palestinian man, was filmed being gang raped. So why would, if the media cares about this, it's one thing to be like, okay, they thought that people were raped on October 7th. But once you say, well, why would the same media who talks about that not mention the thing that we know happened? Like that, again, you just chip away at people's like belief in that system, because the mainstream media, I mean, like a couple of weeks ago, they just made up a lie out of whole cloth that Rashida Tlaib had criticized the attorney general of Michigan for prosecuting students at Michigan because she was Jewish. Like they said that was what she was criticizing her for. Jake Tapper said it. Then Jewish Insider said it. Then the ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, of course, said it. Then Jake Tapper tweeted ADL's thing out. Then Dana Bash did a thing on it. And then because there was this public backlash a lot on social media, it was the biggest non-correction. It was like, oh, sorry, when I said that that Rashida Tlaib was an anti-Semite when she criticized the Michigan AG, I didn't mean to say that. I meant to say that the Michigan AG said that she was an anti-Semite. So Michigan AG, tell us why she's an anti-Semite. He literally had her on to make the point. And then Dana Bash did something similar. But her original thing was amazing. Her original segment was about how both parties have a problem calling out anti-Semitism. And her example was that Tom Cotton refused to condemn Trump for saying that if he loses, it's going to be because of the Jews. That's the Republican side. And on the Democrat side, Gretchen Whitmer refused to condemn Rashida Tlaib for singling out Dana Nessel, the AG of Michigan, for being Jewish, except she didn't do that. I mean, they love both sides in anti-Semitism. And I think Ali Abu Nima came up with that term. But it is, for people who claim to take anti-Semitism seriously, the idea that you're going to equate someone who goes into like a synagogue in Pittsburgh and shoots people because they're Jewish, you're going to equate that with people who are marching for the right of Palestinians. You don't care about anti-Semitism. All you're doing is putting Jews at risk when you do that. So those people also need to be called out. Yeah.
Thank you. I might be showing my ignorance here, but I'm very curious. What's this famous or infamous passage in the Bible which so rivens the Zionists to lay claim to that land where they can kill the people, dispossess them? I'm ignorant of it, and I would like to know what exactly the passage says in the Bible.
Any more biblically oriented people than others? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. What I'll say is that, like, I feel like every religion has, or do you have a response to that? You know?
Well, I actually just started reading Ilan Pape's new book. Lobbying for Zionism on both sides of the Atlantic.
Oh,
and he starts with the first chapter is about how Zionism began as a Christian idea.
Yeah.
So I don't have the exact quote from the Bible, but it is something in Europe where they had this idea of kind of like attaching the Holy Land, which is in the Middle East, into like the European imagination, right? And then coupled with the centuries of anti-Semitism kind of created the perfect storm for the Zionist project. So it does start as like a Christian idea that gets used later in the 1800s by the Zionists. But yeah, I don't have the quote, unfortunately. But the book is very good. You guys should check it out.
I mean, that reminds me, another way that you can try to, I think, obviously, this is a whole thing. Like, who do you try to recruit? Whose job is it? Like, it's. I think, like, Jews should talk to other Jews about this. And, like, you know, white people from, I don't want to sound like a Northeastern elitist. Okay, white people from certain areas should talk to their uncles about it or whatever. Like, but in terms of breaking the spell, I do think another good thing is to remind people, look, you think that this is a moral issue about, like, peace and love and democracy, then why are all these Democrats for Israel, like Chuck Schumer and Brent Gelner? Is that his name? Brent Gelman, that actor? I mean, he's a nobody, but whatever. Why are they at protests with Mike Hagee? Like, they're sharing the stage with Mike Hagee. He was someone who said that Hitler was sent by God to get Jews to go to the Holy Land. And because Christian Zionists want Jews to go to Israel, back to Israel. And like, most of us will be killed. Some of us get to convert. What a choice. But I think the important thing with religious arguments, and I don't know the answer to that, but like, you can find the two opposing messages in the same text. I mean, you can, Jesus says this and another gospel says that.
I mean, that lady was claiming that.
Yeah.
Fame was saying that. So I was just wondering what exactly.
I don't know what it is, but there's lots of things that we like, we can't wear. I don't know, mixed like fabrics, like shellfish, circumcision, whatever. It's, you know. So whenever people say that, it's like, okay, well, then go do these other things. But yeah, I am curious about what it is. But
all right, thank you.
But yeah, even among Zionists, I mean, I think sometimes people think like the most extremist people are the most religious. I think it was Norman Finkelstein who made the point that that's not always true. And yeah, like I would love to have had, I invited him, he couldn't come, but Yaakov Shapiro, who's this great rabbi who I've had on my show, I mean, he would be able to demolish this with like, you know, textual analysis. Okay, yeah. You, then you, and then we'll really wrap.
In my opinion, it was almost impossible for Hamas, 4,000 Hamas, to invade Israel for 7 hours without a response. And I believe, in my opinion, that the lack of response needs to be considered that it was actually a setup for Israel to get into Gaza and to retaliate for something that didn't really necessarily happen. And I don't understand why people aren't emphasizing that it's impossible for them to have come over the border, 4,000 of them, stayed for 7 hours, and were allowed to leave with all of the people that they left with, and have Israel be unresponsive.
So I don't know if anyone's watching Abu Obeidah. He did talk about how this was a preemptive strike because Gaza after the West Bank was next to be cleansed. So they've been planning this preemptive. They've known that Israel wanted to cleanse the West Bank this year. Now has been held up because a lot of people don't realize, even because everything has context, even before October 7th, they killed 2,000 people in the West Bank, Israel. They were trying to clear the West Bank this year. Like, this is a preemptive strike because Gaza was next. Now,
and I think it's
like 700. Yeah, that would be probably more as well. The reason there's a slow response, and again, you know, you could argue that, yeah, it's a bit weird the IDF took so, or the IOF took so long, but it's everyone was in the West Bank. They all deployed there. The goal was to literally within the next 12 or from last October to supposed to be the summer this year, to empty the West Bank of Palestinians.
So it was caught off guard. 7 hours. I mean, I think a lot of them started to respond before then. The actual full force got there in 7 hours. There is like firefights over the course of 7 hours. It wasn't just they hung around for 7 hours and left. So it's not completely accurate that they took 7 hours to respond. But it's perfectly plausible they were there for ages because they were completely caught off guard. Remember, Hamas is also like a sophisticated, this is what I want to get out of people's mindset, right? Like about this, like even Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's doing an amazing job showing the media for what it is. The one thing I didn't like about what he said, he's like, oh, resistance is an act of desperation. It's not, it's an act of revolution and bravery. These soldiers are fighting for their people's existence, have been planning this for a year. They knew when to hit them, and they were watching the West Bank and seeing the escalation, the troop movement. We think of our intelligence of being sophisticated and Israel's intelligence. They're sophisticated. Hezbollah. Yeah, that's about all they're good at. Like, again, Hezbollah literally targeted a general in his barracks. And these they are all sophisticated too. They know where their targets are. The reason Israel can't clear Al-Qassam right now is because they're better at fighting on the ground than Israel. Israel literally only knows how to kill civilians. That's all they're good at. Pretty much similar to our government, if you look at Iraq. Like 800,000 people. That's what we did, right?
So they covered it up.
Yeah.
Wonder if we had cell phones, though. Think about that. And remember, you got to consider that the most famous picture of Abu Ghraib was a U.S. soldier taking this freaking old, you know, the cameras where you don't know what's on the thing, took it to a pharmacy to get the photos developed, and the pharmacist reported it. And Piers Morgan, for all his shit, published that story and broke Abu Ghraib. Sorry, giving him some credit. Like, but it's a great... Like unintentional good. Yeah. So my point about the Hamas thing, like they're more sophisticated than we give them credit for. They're a resistance group that's got a great intelligence. Listen to Abu Obeidah. This was a preemptive strike against Israeli forces in that region because they knew after the West Bank, Gaza was next.
So you don't think it was a cover-up?
I mean, I think Netanyahu has a lot to... I think
and
Netanyahu,
a setup for the
Netanyahu is funded. It's documented he funded Hamas for years to like separate the PA and Hamas, but also like he did it to keep them quiet. Like they're still a resistance group. We're just waiting for their moment to strike. Like yes, they're going to take that funding to do what they need to do. Like he's culpable for many crimes, which includes funding them. But Hamas was always going to strike at some point because, like, what population under occupation were there being? What do they call it? Mowing the lawn, where they kill a few thousand of your people every year, is going to sit there quietly in the end and not strike back. You wouldn't. If they were mowing the lawn in New Jersey and killing 2,000 people there or New York, we'd fight back. I would like to believe we would. Against whatever occupation did that. We wouldn't accept that, nor should they.
Thank you. Oh, okay, final question, sorry.
Thank you. jump in. Shortly, about presidential elections, I would just like to suggest, actually, that we have a chance in New York to feel comfortable to vote for Jill Stein.
I'm doing that.
Yes. So we do have a good choice and feel okay. My question. Oh, great. And my question is about this possibility, what to do. And the question came from something I saw on a Facebook, which is petition for forming some international military group that would be actually go there and fight.
Foreign Legion, like they mentioned in the film.
So my question is, what do you think about such a possibility?
We're live streaming now. I don't know if I can say what I think.
This feels like a setup. No. No,
I'm kidding. The UN has a measure. The UN has a measure where the Secretary General can take control of the whole council and send military. He refused. Yeah, yes. I'm probably already on a watch list at this point. The UN has a measure, and I forgot the exact coding for it, but effectively, the Secretary General can not dissolve the Security Council, take control of the Security Council, and send a military force to protect a population. You have to ask yourself why the Secretary General is not doing that. So he literally has the power to stop this today. And we all know the UN has been like decapitated and taken apart since Iraq. We only have to look at what Bush and Blair put Kofi Annan through and how they destabilized the whole operation. But that measure still exists. And we used it. I can't remember. We have used it in one war before. I've forgotten what it is off the top of my head. No, that actually we supported going in the end. That was NATO. But we have used that measure before. There is one other time it's been used. And I've forgotten the exact time. But we have actually intervened. And the Secretary General has called for that intervention. I think it was while the Cold War was on. So it's been used rarely, but it can be used. And people should be putting pressure on the Secretary General and getting their governments and diplomats and ambassadors put pressure on him, because it's not the Security Council doesn't control it completely. He has one power that he can do this with. And he could easily get troops. There are troops that would volunteer from Malaysia to South Africa to Brazil right now who would volunteer that mission. Just look what the Irish and the Spanish are doing in Lebanon. They refuse to leave. Everyone's talking about the Irish because they're getting directly shot at. But there are multiple peacekeepers there who would fight to protect the Palestinian people if given permission. So the troops are there. Our Secretary General refuses to do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that comes to mind is the Spanish Civil War. I mean, people came from all over the world to Spain to fight fascism there.
Didn't work.
Yeah, unfortunately. The sentiment, you know,
yeah.
I think if there was a call like that and they veiled, like the opportunity was there, I think, you know, tons of people would take advantage of it, would do that 100%.
I just worry that the righteous side is so outarmed and so outfunded.
Yeah, the asymmetry.
Yeah, it's true. Well, thank you guys so much for coming. Anyone want to plug anything? Thank you, the People's Forum. Anything Code Pink wants to say? Yeah. Subscribe to youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show if you're not already. Anything Code Pink wants to say? Yeah. Or TRT? Are you here on official TRT repping? Oh, okay.
There's a Palestine convention happening in Chicago in November. Palestineconvention.org is the website. It's the largest Palestinian convention every year. Thanksgiving holiday. Your permission. But I usually go there every year, and it's usually last year, I think like a couple thousand people attended. Ilan Pape and other speakers, they show up. So if you have time, 3 days, come to Chicago. Just look up PalestineConvention.org. I hope to see you guys there.
Thank you. Yeah.
JillStein.com. Definitely support that. Oh, sorry. Personally, I support that. Yeah. Unofficially. So we have two petitions up here from Code Pink. We have one for sanctioning Israeli settler groups in Palestine and another for letting journalists into Gaza. We'd really appreciate if you could sign those two petitions. Thank you for coming, everyone. I tried. My first time. Thank you.
And I mean, all y'all are here in People's Forum, but I know that they hold a volunteer meeting every Monday. So whatever borough you're in, even Jersey, I guess we can also do it through Zoom. But in People's Forum on Monday nights, I believe they have a volunteer meeting. So whatever borough you're at, you can meet up with other folks. So if you don't know where to start, that's a good place.
Thanks, everyone.